We're talking about the encounter between Moshe and the God at the burning bush. And it seems like a major theme is the Moshe's resistance to assuming the mission that God placed upon him. And we're taking up the matter of the signs. God gave him three different signs. What's the role of the signs? Just before we begin, tangentially, it seems a little bit strange from my perspective. Obviously, I'm missing something. That after Moshe requested signs, and God gave him the signs, there were three different miracles performed. The specific question that's triggered off this discussion is, what's the idea of three? Why is it that three would be sufficient as opposed to one? However, before we get to that, I'm just noting that even after God gives him the signs, he goes back to his theme and pleads with God to release him from the obligation. And superficially, this would seem to be questionable behavior on the part of Moshe. For he's had the benefit, there is a benefit in seeing these signs. I would assume that God performed them for him only because he would need them. And if, for example, God had accepted his plea and released him from the mission before the demonstration of the signs, so, and then Moshe would have said, well, let me see the signs anyways, I'd like to see them, it wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have made any sense. The whole purpose of the signs was because he needed them for the mission. Therefore, it would seem, in terms of the appropriate thing, derech eretz, the appropriate thing to do, that before a person would ask for the signs, he would have dealt with all the personal issues. Moshe Rabbeinu resisted the mission. The resistance came from two sides. And it seems possible that this is the way Rashi learns the pasuk. In fact, to go to the beginning of the discussion, after Moshe decides to turn and get closer to the burning bush, then God speaks to him. The angel of God speaks to him. So God speaks to Moshe, and essentially the message seems to be that the time has come. That God has heard the screams of the Jews. God has taken notice of the affliction. And God has decided to intervene. That's in Ches, Va'ered. So to speak, I'm coming down to save him from Egypt and to bring him up from that land to, it doesn't specify, or it's Canaan, it says the land which is goodly and broad, it flows, milk and honey, and then it identifies it, the land of the Canaan, the Chiti, the Amori, and so forth. That's the land of Canaan. And then, in Tess, the screams, which is a reference to the tefillah of Bnei Israel, has reached God, so to speak, that is, God's taking note of it. And the affliction that they're receiving from Mitzrayim, and Yud. So, of course, in the first pasuk it mentioned, the Chesed says that God is coming down. But specifically what this means is in Yud. Because if God is coming down, so what is Moshe needed for? Well, it means to say that the deliverance is going to manifest itself through a particular medium. And the medium is going to be Moshe Rabbeinu. So the Atalacha, now go, and I will send you to Paro and remove my nation, the Bnei Israel, from Egypt. So Moshe's initial response seems to be, according to the way Rashi learns it, to cover the entire range of his objections. Vayomer Moshe Elokim, Moshe said to God, Mi anochi ki elech el Paro? Who am I that I should go to Paro? V'chiotzi es bnei Yisrael mi Mitzrayim, and that I should remove the Jews from Egypt. So let's pause and analyze that pasuk. First of all, what does he mean? Who am I? What does that mean? God has chosen you. That's who you are. You're the one who God has chosen.
It seems like that.
Take a look at the Rashi on Mi Anochi. Mani Choshev L'daber Im Hamalachim. What chashivas, what significance do I have? Worthiness do I have to speak to kings? So essentially, Mi Anochi, I don't have the qualities. Because you're sending me on a mission to negotiate with kings. So a person has to be on a certain level where he's capable of doing that. Not everybody could do that. So Moshe Rabbeinu was saying that he doesn't have the ability to do that. What's the second idea? V'chiyotzi. So the way Rashi learns, V'af im choshev ani, and even if I am, that is to say, even let's say I'm mistaken, or even if I were, there's another objection. Ma zachu Yisrael she'yasa lahem neis v'yotziyom imitzrayim. What merit do the Jews have that God should perform a miracle for them and I will take them out of Egypt? Before we pursue specifically the Rashi on this, in general, then, there were two problems here, as far as Moshe was concerned. One pertained to himself, his own abilities or lack of abilities. He seems to focus specifically on the speech impediment. That's the main argument that he uses, which we can understand. Generally speaking, a leader has to have a certain charisma, and the most important element, especially in ancient times, but it's true even today, is a good speaker, someone who can communicate with the people. So that Moshe Rabbeinu was more than simply the physical impediment, that's part of it, but I assume it's the entire personality. He wasn't that kind of a person. He was an abstract theoretician. He wasn't a practical leader of the people that could stir people's emotions by fiery rhetoric. So that's the main argument that he uses. And that doesn't mean that that's the only resistance, that's the only problem that he has internally, but that's the one that he focuses on. But then there's another set of issues in terms of the objective character of the mission. To deal with the Jews, to convince the Jews. How is he going to convince the Jews that God spoke to him? That comes up in the conversation. And also, how is he going to be able to succeed in winning the Jews over to him? It's more than simply getting them to leave the land. In the process of doing so, they had to accept Moshe as their leader. And we see that there were other things involved. For example, the command to bring the Korban Pesach. So his job was to bring them into a certain state of willingness to follow the Torah, to get them. That was part of the mission. So they had to accept him as their leader. So there were two challenges over there. There was the issues that pertain to himself, and then there were those that pertain to the objective character of the mission. Now let's get back to Rashi. On Yud Beis, Vayomer ki yeh imach, and God said, "For I will be with you." V'zelecha os ki anochi shlachticha, and this will be for you the sign that I have sent you. Botziecha es ha'ami Mitzrayim, when you take the nation out of Egypt, tavdun es ha'lokim al ha'hor hazeh, they will serve God on this mountain. Of course, this pasuk is very difficult. On the surface, the pasuk is difficult because it seems to be saying that this will be the sign that I sent you. If a person needs a sign that he was sent by God, so the sign has to be something which is in existence right now that he could point to. But you can't have a sign which is going to be in the future. How can you use such a thing to convince people? You need to convince them now. You can't convince them by saying that in the future we're going to worship God on Mount Sinai. That's not a proof. That's not a sign. So that's the difficulty with the plain interpretation of the pasuk. Let's take a look at the way Rashi explains it. Yud beis vayomer kiyei imach. So Rashi says, Heshivo al rishon rishon v'al achron achron. Rashi, in accordance with his interpretation, learns that God addressed both issues. There were two questions. Shamarta mi anochi kiyei lech al paro. Regarding that which you said, who am I to go to Paro? Lo shalachi ki im mishali. It's not yours, but it's from me. Ki eye imach, for I will be with you. So that's basically addressing his concern. We'll have to explain that. Vizeh hamara asher isa basna, and this vision which you saw in the snare, l'cho ha'os, is the sign, ki anochi shlachticha, that I sent you, uchadai ani lahatzon, that I have the power to save. So the way Rashi is learning is that v'zeh l'cho ha'os, is this is the sign for you, is disconnected from b'hotziach es ha'ami Mitzrayim. When you take the people out of Egypt, they'll worship God on this mountain. That's not the sign, the way Rashi learns. Rashi breaks up the pasuk into different parts. And continuing with this thought, Kasher Ra'isa Hasna, Osa Shlichusi, V'einena Ukol. See, Rashi also learns that the Sna has more than one objective. It's not merely to demonstrate that God controls nature, the power of God, but it has a specific meaning, specific significance. Kach telech bishlichusi, so too you will go at my behest as my messenger, v'eincha nizok, and you will not be harmed. V'shesha alta, and concerning that which you asked, Mazchus Yeshli Yisrael, Sheyetzum Mitzrayim, what merit do the Jews have that they should go out of Egypt? Dover Gadol Yeshli Alotzazu. I have some great thing pertaining to this Exodus. Sherei Asidim Lekabel HaTorah Al Har Sinai. They are destined to receive the Torah on Har Sinai, Lesof Shlosha Chadashim, Sheyetzim Mitzrayim, at the end of 3 months, after they leave Egypt. So then Rashi gives another interpretation, but let's deal with this interpretation. The way Rashi learns it, that Pasuk Yud Beis is answering both of Moshe's questions. The first one is, Kiyei Eimach, V'zelecha Ha'os Ki'anochi Shlachticha. Stop, or pause. That's the answer to the first question. Because you asked, who are you? And the answer is, I'll be with you. And proof of that is the vision of the what you saw in the snap. With regard to your second question, what merit do they have? So the answer is, Bo'tziacha Esa'om Mitzrayim. The answer to that question is, the merit is that in the future, when 3 months after they leave Egypt, so they'll worship me on this mountain. The problems with the explanation of Rashi is that both of the answers are not that clear, because how does the fact that I'll be with you, how does that answer the question of who am I? If you're not worthy, as Moshe said, then you're still not worthy. How does that answer the question? And the other part, that with regard to the Jews' merit, that the merit is that they'll worship God on this mountain, also needs to be explained, because generally speaking, when a person asks the question, it means what merit do they have now? What have they done to deserve this? The fact that they're going to be doing something in the future seems to be a different idea. The Sforno says, Kiyei Eimach, V'zelecha Ha'os. The Sforno says, Shetigzor Omer V'yakimlach B'chol asher tifneh sham. That is that you, Moshe, will decree something and it will be established. So he's giving him tremendous power. You'll decree a thing and it will be established for you wherever you will turn. And all will recognize that I sent you and will respect you and your words. And he quotes the pasuk, Gam ha'ish Moshe gadol miyod be'eretz Mitzrayim. That the man Moshe was very great in the land of Egypt. So that's his interpretation. What does that mean? That would answer the question. That is to say that he's not being appointed on the basis of his own capabilities and being charged with the responsibility purely on, you know, in a natural way to arrange things, to organize, to negotiate, and so forth. That's one type of a phenomenon where the mission is given over to a particular person. But here, I'll be with you. That is to say that God is going to be directly involved. And as the Sforno explains, in a manner that will solidify and convince people that he's representing HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That he'll, so to speak, decree, and it'll come about in a miraculous fashion. So therefore, there's no basis for the objection. It's not the success of the mission won't be dependent upon your powers and your abilities. It's a different phenomenon. It's going to be successful because of your relationship with me and what I'm going to be involved in. The reason why Moshe asked the question as to their merit is, would seem, that the Jews at that time had strayed from the derech of the Avos and had become engaged in avodah zarah. Rashi makes that point, in idolatry. And that point is made at the explanation of the Korban Pesach, the Passover sacrifice, which has the objective, mishchu u'kachu, draw your hands away from the sheep of idolatry and take hold of a seshal mitzvah. So that was the basic test in terms of the Korban Pesach. The Jews had to transform themselves up to a certain level where they weren't steeped in base idolatry. And if that is the case, that was a serious issue, that to a large extent the Jews had abandoned the derech of the fathers of the Avos, so then Moshe would be justified in raising the question, what's their merit? They're no longer a special people. They're no longer distinct. The answer then would be, in a sense, that Moshe is correct, according to this. That is true. In terms of the situation now, in terms of where they are right now, they don't deserve it. But I have a davar gadol. That is to say that the experience of Sinai will be such that it will transform them. Which would mean to say that it doesn't mean that Moshe's question that he thought that that they're just going to be taken out and they're not going to get the idea that God would take them out for a purpose, that he's not just going to take them out, but he's taking them out for a purpose. Well, Moshe knew that when he raised the question. But that's precisely why he asked. They're not fit for a purpose. He knew that they were destined to be, they were supposed to be, a special nation. That was to carry on the philosophy of the Avos. That Moshe Rabbeinu knew. But it would appear that they had completely lost that. It had been obliterated as a result of the experiences in Mitzrayim, the assimilation, then the affliction, the oppression, all these different factors which broke them down. And so you'll take them out of the enslavement, so they'll still be slaves. What's the point? But God is telling him that there's going to be something which is very, very unique and very special and very different, and it's going to have a complete impact on them, and it's going to transform them and remove, at least sufficiently to remove, the corruptions that they had become involved in Egypt sufficiently so that they could receive the Torah and make a beginning. Obviously, we see that that generation couldn't make it all the way into the Eretz Yisrael. But nevertheless, that's what God is telling Moshe. There's no reason to assume that Moshe knew about the Sinai. How would he know that? What form this would take? Let's assume that Moshe knew that that was the whole idea. That the uniqueness of this people was that they were B'nai Yisrael. They would carry on that way of life, that derech, and become a unique nation. However, that there would be a Ma'amad Har Sinai, a revelation at Sinai, and all the particularities of Torah, and so on and so forth, there's no reason to assume that Moshe knew all of that. Certainly, even if he knew that God was going to give a system to them, a specific system which would incorporate the principles, the philosophy of the Avos, but I don't know that he knew about the event of Ma'amad Har Sinai, that event, which is a very significant event, and the fact that they heard the voice of God, so to speak, and that they requested that God should speak to us and at first, and that was very good, but then they couldn't even tolerate that, the element of fear, and then they pleaded with Moshe that Moshe should be the intermediary between them and God. This was a tremendous transformation in the psyche of the people. Just to illustrate the effect of the experience of Sinai that it had on those who were there and their descendants, on the Jewish people. So Chazal say that caused Chava to sin, so it implanted a certain type of a zuhama, a certain type of a filth in mankind. But it says that Yisrael, as a result of the fact that they accepted the Torah, Poska zuhamasam, it came to an end, that the impurity. So, the general idea, I'm not going into the specific, the general idea is that the experience itself, the very experience of Sinai, had a tremendous impact upon removing impediments within the psyche and bringing the Jews into a different relationship with God. So that I think, would fit in very nicely into the answer. That's exactly what Hashem is telling them. That is to say that Moshe may be justified. According to this way of learning, the question is justified. It's not a bad question. You're right. All things being equal, if you look at the way they are now, they're not deserving. But if you were aware of the Davar Gadol, this great matter, the event at Sinai, and the effect it's going to have on them, so then you'd understand what the purpose is. Now, Pasuk Yud Gimel, the next phase, Vayomer Moshe el Elokim, so Moshe said to God, Hine Anochi Boel B'nai Yisrael, I will come to the B'nai Yisrael. Now he seems to be dealing with the mission to the B'nai Yisrael, to the Jews. As we pointed out, there was two separate missions. One was to Paro, to negotiate with Paro. That's one set of problems. But then, to come to the Jews. And I'll say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me unto you. And then they'll say, what's his name? What shall I say to them? The whole idea of asking God the name and Moshe telling them the name is a problem. Of course, what does it prove? What does it demonstrate? As the Ramban says, that if they believed in God by this name, as known by this name, so the fact that Moshe knows the name of the God is not going to prove anything that God spoke to him, so he would know the name too. He would know the name just like they would know the name. What's the difference? And if they didn't believe, so Moshe's telling them the name is not going to change anything. Well, what's the point of the name? The name obviously was not a secret. And since the name was not a secret which would indicate anything, then Moshe's knowing the name on the surface wouldn't seem to make a difference. So God said, Vayomer Elokim El Moshe, God said to Moshe, Ekyer Asher Ekyer. All right, we'll just leave that without translating it, because that already indicates to us that it wasn't just a name. We never even use that, basically. But that's the name, when they ask for the name, that's what Moshe is supposed to use. Ek Vayomer, and he said, Ko somar levnei Yisrael, thus shall you say to Bnei Yisrael, Ek Yeshlachani Aleichem. That Ekya has sent me to you. That's interesting the way the pasuk is structured, because in answering Moshe's question, God says Ekyer Asher Ekyer. And then he says, when you go to them, you should say Ekyer. Shouldn't it be Ekyer Asher Ekyer Shlachani Aleichem? There's a very fascinating Rashi on Yud Dalad. I don't think that Rashi here is intending to explain the pasuk on the level of pshat. It's just conveying another midrashic idea. Because Ekya Asher Ekya, Ekya literally means I will be. So the implication, the allusion over here is Ekya Imam B'tzarazos. I will be with them in this tzara, in this suffering. That's one Ekya. So it means to say Ekya, the one who will be with you, using it in this context. The way Rashi is learning it midrashically. The one who will be with you in this suffering, in this tragedy. Asher Ekya, who will also be, meaning that he'll be with you in the future. Bishibud Sha'ar Malchios, when you are subdued by the other kingdoms. So essentially, it's conveying the idea that this is the being who will be with you in this suffering, and will be with you in all the future sufferings. So Rashi now is going to explain why it became abbreviated from Ekya Asher Ekya to Ekya. Amar Lefanav, so God said to him, Ribono Shel Olam, Master of the Universe, Ma Ani Maskil Lahem Tzara Acheres, why should I mention other sufferings? Why bring it up now? Dayam B'Tzara Zo, it's enough that they have this suffering. Amalo, God said to him, Yofa Amarta, you spoke well. You're right. And therefore, Kosomar, thus shall you say, Ekya. In other words, abbreviated. Clearly, the name Ekya Asher Ekya, we have a basic idea anyways, in terms of approaching it. And the Rambam expounds upon this. You see from this that it wasn't the kind of name we're talking about, an ordinary name of identification, which may not have any significance. You want to know if a spy wants to make a contact, so who sent you? So then you're using a name. The name doesn't have to have any significance. It's just a name. And if it's the right name, it's, of course, nobody knows that name. It's a secret. It's a code. And this serves to confirm that you were sent by that person. So that's fine. This is not the situation over here. Over here, it's something else. The idea of the name has a completely different connotation. It's also important to know who will be asking this question. When Moshe speaks about going to the Jews and the conversation, who is he speaking to? Is he talking to the masses? Obviously, we'd assume it's through their representatives. But basically, is this a message that's designed for the masses of Jews? Or is it designed for a specific group, for the elders, for the Chachamim? When they would ask, when Moshe referred to the fact that they'll ask me God's name, clearly it doesn't mean an ordinary name. The name over here, the Shem Hashem, we find that by Avram Avinu, Vayikra B'Shem Hashem, that the name of God means the concept that we have of God. That's very, very important, because the word God per se doesn't mean much. Everybody believes in God. Idol worshippers believe in God, but what's their idea of God? What God do they believe in? That's crucial. And what they imagine to be God, is that have reality, or is that just a figment of their imagination? So they don't believe in anything. That's avodah zarah. Thus, Moshe was saying, when they'll ask me the name. He's talking about the Chachamim. And they'll want to know what the concept I have of God is. Because they've inherited a certain idea of God. Now forget about the rest of the people, what we mentioned before, whether the people are still observing the derech, the way of the Avos, but they still have Chachamim, who retain the true knowledge. And they will be testing me. Because if I'm going to come in front of them, I'm going to be making a very huge claim over here. It's a very big claim. I'm claiming that I'm a prophet and I'm a messenger. That God, the same God that you believe in and that revealed himself to your forefathers, to Avram, to Yitzchak, and all of that, you know, so forth, spoke to me. And this is it. This is the time. The time has come, and I'm going to be his messenger. Now, they're not just going to accept that. They're going to challenge that. Moshe is getting into that. And indeed, we have to connect this question with the question of the signs. Because then he says, but they will not believe v'hem lo yaminu li. They won't believe me. That he raises after God gives him the name. So we have to connect the two. But the way the Rambam explains it, what he was really asking was, by what name? Which is the concept. They have a specific concept of God, and they refer to it in a certain way. That concept is explained, identified in a certain way, and they're going to be testing me, and I must convince them that I understand this idea that they have. It's the same idea of God that they have. That in and of itself, however, that's the starting point. In and of itself, the fact that he has this knowledge does not prove that God has sent him. But it's essential, because if he doesn't have this knowledge, then that's it. He's disqualified automatically. So while it's essential and necessary, it's not sufficient in and of itself. But it would be a disqualifying factor. If he did not have the correct concept of God, then they would not have been interested in any kind of signs that he could have performed.
According to the Orlo,
Sinai, who maintained Sinai. This is the process of assimilation. Imagine, is anybody going to stand up and be capable of winning the Jews over, reversing, stopping that whole trend? Well, this was the assignment that God had given to Moshe Rabbeinu as far as the Jews are concerned. This might have been a much more difficult aspect of the mission. Moshe is addressing that part of the question. Before we proceed, I want to point something out. As I mentioned before, Rashi, on the basis of some of the terms, phrases that Moshe uses, refers to yesterday and the day before yesterday, and so on. This is the view of the rabbis of Chazal, that this dialogue takes place over a span of 7 days. It is, the Torah does record a lot of it, in terms of Torah space, how much space the Torah generally accords to conversations, because the Torah only records the essences of it. It doesn't record every word, it's not a transcript. However, at this point in time, you see Moshe is addressing himself to the issue of how he's going to establish himself with regard to the Jews. Yet, if you take a look at the dialogue up to this point, it doesn't say that God instructed him to go to the Jews and to establish himself as God's messenger in terms of the Jewish people. In chapter 3, verse 10, after God's introduction about the suffering of the Jews, it says, "And now go, and I'll send you unto Paro, and remove my nation Israel from Egypt." It is true that this verse, "and take out my nation Israel," does allude to the idea that part of the job is to put them in a situation, a state, where they'd be willing to go. But it's not impossible to say that just negotiate with Paro and he'll send them out, he'll drive them out. However, we have to assume that this was communicated specifically to Moshe Rabbeinu. Therefore, it makes sense to assume that much more dialogue occurred than is being recorded over here, and that the idea that part of the mission is to the Jewish people to put an end to the process of assimilation and to make them God's nation
That's part of the mission. Because this is what Moshe asks. This is the basis of Moshe's question, that when I come to the Jews and I say to them that the God of your fathers has sent me unto you. So he's referring to this aspect of the mission. They will say, what is his name? What should I say unto them? So this is a fascinating aspect of the dialogue. What is the real question over here? On the surface, it doesn't seem to make sense. Because if the Jews, whatever name they ascribed to their God, whatever they knew their God by, whatever name, Moshe would know it, to find out. What's the problem? Either we would assume that Moshe would know it. Because Moshe studied a great deal before he left Egypt. He studied what was going on with the Jews. He knew about the Jews. He might have kept track since then. We don't know what he did. But whatever, what's the problem? When you go back to Egypt, you'll find out what the name of their God is, and that's the name. The question is strange. Nevertheless, God answers, and God says to Moshe, this is the name, Ekyeh Asher Ekyeh. Which literally would seem to be, Ekyeh as I will be, Asher, I will be that I will be. And God said, thus shall you say to Bnei Israel, Ekyeh, I will be, Shlachani Aleichem, has sent me unto you. So we don't understand the meaning at first glance. It's not self-evident, but it has to be explained. But then God said further to Moshe, thus shall you say to the Bnei Israel, Hashem, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, has sent me unto you. This is my name forever, and this is my remembrance from generation to generation. Well, then we have to explain the two names. What is the idea of both names? Let's follow the trend. Let's see what happens. Then God says, and this is in 16, verse 16, go and gather the elders of Israel and say to them, Hashem, the God of your fathers, has appeared to me, the God of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, saying, I have remembered you and that which was done unto you in Egypt. And I have said, I will bring you up from the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaan, Chiti, Amori, and so forth, to the land which flows milk and honey. So that's the message that God said to give them. Then, in 18, God says, V'shamu l'kolecha, they will listen to you. And you will go, you and the elders of Israel, they'll go to the king of Egypt and say to him that Hashem, the God of the Ivrim, has appeared to us. And now, let us please go a journey, a distance of 3 days in the wilderness, and we'll sacrifice to the Lord our God. What's interesting about this is that it seems that Moshe, at this point, was not supposed to go alone. The impression we got at the beginning was that Moshe would go alone. He would do the negotiating with Paro. Here, however, God is telling him that they will listen to you and they will go with you to Paro. Continuing now in 19, and I know, says God, that the king of Egypt will not give you permission to go, except with a strong hand. And I will send forth my hand and smite Egypt with all of my wondrous deeds that I will do amongst them. And afterwards he will send you out. And I will place the charm of this nation in the eyes of Egypt. And it'll be that when they leave, they will not leave empty-handed. And a woman will ask of her neighbor, and the person who's living with her in the house, like a servant, she'll request vessels of silver, vessels of gold and clothing, and they'll be placed upon your children, your sons and your daughters, and you'll empty out the Egyptians. But you'll acquire a tremendous amount. That's always a fascinating aspect. It's a detail in the story. We have to question what is the significance of that, and why is it being told at this particular point even. But apparently it's a very significant aspect of the story. It goes back, even when God told Abraham, when God told him about the forthcoming, what would happen to the children, and they'd be enslaved, mentioned the fact that when they would be freed, they'd be freed with great wealth. This theme is mentioned a number of times, now, and it's told to Moshe, and Moshe is supposed to tell to the Jews at the very outset. It's a very significant theme. This is the answer that God gives, even though it seems that God is giving much more in the answer than Moshe requested. Moshe only requested the name. God gives him more than one name. Gives him the name of Ekiah, as well as the God of your fathers. Then God tells him that they will listen to you. So if the concern of Moshe was that he needed some way to prove to them that God had spoken to him. And that's the reason for making the request. That he definitely anticipated that there would be resistance. Why should they believe him? And therefore he would need to know the name. So God answers him. But God assures him that they will listen to you, and they'll actually not just listen to you, but they'll go with you to Paro. So it seems that God is telling him that there will not be a problem as far as this is concerned. But what happens next is very strange. Then Moshe replies, Vayar Moshe. And Moshe replies and says, Vehen lo yaminu li. They will not listen to me. Nor will they listen to my voice. Which seems to be contradicting what God said. Ki yomru, for they will say, Lo nirei lech Hashem. God did not appear to you. Ooh, whoa, one second. God just told them that they will listen, and they will go with you. Moshe is saying they won't. And they will say, Lo nirei lech Hashem. God didn't appear to you. How can Moshe say anything like that? First of all, on what basis? Anyways, I mean, God is telling him. God knows everything. If God says that they're going to listen, so of course they're going to listen. Chazal, of course, criticized Moshe Rabbeinu, as we'll soon see, for saying this about the Jews. Vehein lo yaminu li, that they will not believe. However, God does not rebuke him for this. To the contrary, God proceeds to give him signs. Vayomer lo Hashem, and God said to him, what is that in your hand? And he said, it's a staff. And God said, cast it to the ground. And he cast it to the ground, and it became a snake. And Moshe runs away from it. And God said to Moshe, stretch out your hand and grab onto its tail. And Moshe stretched out his hand and grabbed it, and it turned into a staff. What's interesting over here is that, logically speaking, anyone that works with snakes would not grab a snake by the tail. You don't grab a snake by the tail. That's not a good place to grab it, because the mouth is then free to strike you. You're supposed to grab it by the mouth, thereby preventing it from biting you. It's an interesting point. Why would the Torah even point it out? That God told them to pick it up. But God specifically told them to pick it up by the tail. And a number of years ago, a student of mine at the Rambam Mesifta in high school made the point that from a logical standpoint, again, you don't pick up a snake by the tail. So it seems that this too was to demonstrate to Moshe Rabbeinu another aspect, that under the control of God, it doesn't matter. This is another element of a miraculous phenomenon, to do what God is saying, to go contrary to your emotions, because emotionally you don't want to. He ran away from the snake, but in the presence of God, these things are not a problem. Anyways, as you know, there's the undertone of criticism directed against Moshe that Rashi says that it wasn't just a random phenomenon. This is an important idea. It's an important idea that the signs are, of course, they demonstrate in a general way the control over the Teva, but they have a particular message. There is a specific idea associated with it. In fact, God says, the kol ha'os, the sign, the voice of the os, the voice of the sign. And here, Rashi points out that the snake contained a message to Moshe, that Moshe spoke Lashon Hara, when he said that the Jews won't believe. That is, he accused the Jews of not being believers. Rashi on 3, Vayila Nachash, Ramazlo, God hinted to him, Shesiper Lashon Hara al Yisrael, that he spoke Lashon Hara about the Jews, Biomro Lo Yaminuli, when he said about them that they won't believe in me. The tafas umnaso shel nachash, and he sees, so to speak, the skill. The nachash sinned with speech. Now this is a fascinating idea, because it's a subterranean phenomenon. It's not on the level of the text. On the level of the text, the God is not rebuking Moshe. To the contrary, God is giving Moshe the signs. Thus the question arises, was Moshe's question legitimate? Then God, without any request, then God says to Moshe to place his hand. Well, first you have verse 5, in order that they will believe. Laman Yaminu, which seems to be agreeing with Moshe. That is to say that the God would not have given him the sign if it wasn't necessary. And here God is explaining, in order that they will believe, that God appeared to you, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Then God says in verse 6, place your hand inside of your cloak, inside of by your bosom. And Moshe placed it inside. When he removed it, his hand had contracted leprosy, tzaras. Now everybody knows that tzaras is a punishment. See, there too, it could have been other things. The idea of supernatural, something outside the natural order, controlling things, could have been demonstrated in many, many ways, by many, many changes in the physical properties. But this was tzaras. It produces a particular result. And that particular result is the whole institution of the Torah. That it is the classical punishment that's visited upon people for the chet, for the sin of Lashon Hara. Here it's not a full-blown case of tzaras. But it's a remez, it's a hint. Rashi learns that way. Rashi says, also with this sign, God hinted to him that he had spoken Lashon Hara when he said, they will not believe me. Therefore he was smitten with tzaras. Just like Miriam was smitten with tzaras. Then in Pasuk Ches, God says, it will be. If they won't believe you, and they won't listen to the voice, to the sound, to the message of the first sign, then they will believe the message of the second one. But then it says in Tess, but it will, if they don't listen, believe both of these signs, and they won't listen to your voice, then you shall take from the waters of the Or, of the river, and spill it onto the ground, and the water that you take from the river will turn into blood on the ground. Rashi's comment on the third sign, the third sign does not seem to be a continuation of this theme of punishment of Moshe for saying that they wouldn't believe. But interestingly enough, isn't God saying if they don't listen to the sound, if they don't believe, then I'll give you the second one. They'll believe the second one. And if they don't believe the second one, I'll give you... So that seems to be confirming. So what did Moshe say wrong? But in this one, Rashi says there was a different message, remez. Here he says, remez lahem, that he hinted to them that in the first makeh, in the first plague, God would punish their idol, their deity, which was the Nile. They worshipped the Nile. In parentheses, Rashi has the words, that is, when God avenges nations, he punishes their gods first. Because they worshipped the Nile, which kept them, which sustained them. So Rashi says that God turned it into blood. This confirms the point
that when God intervenes in the natural order, to demonstrate the larger point, of course, the larger point is that everything comes from God. But when God intervenes, the specific method, the particular, has significance. It's a teaching instrument. It's designed to teach ideas, not just the general idea that there's a higher power. It's not indiscriminate. It's with a particular point that a person will benefit from. That in the case of Moshe Rabbeinu, even. In the case of Moshe, there was a message. The message of number one and two, what's the general message? Schar v'onesh, reward and punishment. That's how God relates to the creation, to his creatures. And of course, in this case, we see punishment. Punishment. We see that God's concerned about speech. Lashon hara. And even a case of lashon hara like this, which is very, very subtle, it's hard for us even to figure out what Moshe did wrong. Because the request seems to be acceptable, legitimate. The questions are very tough. They're very, very difficult questions. And we have to focus on the first request, the idea of the name, and what was the meaning of the name, the significance of the name. And once God told Moshe that they would listen, it would seem, as we said before, that the request for the name wasn't just an ordinary kind of a name that people give a name to a place. That's not what we're talking about. It's just a word that people use to refer. It's not a name of reference. That doesn't make any sense. Because first of all, why wouldn't Moshe know that on his own? But more important, what significance would it have? As the Rambam in the Moreh Nevuchim writes, that either the Jews did not know this name that he's talking about, or they did. If they did not know, so then Moshe would come to them and would tell them, so what significance would it have for them if they didn't know this name? On the other hand, if they did know this name, so it meant to say that this name was known, was well known. So just like they would know it, he would know it, and it wouldn't constitute any proof. So that's very, very difficult. And perhaps just as challenging is the question, whatever the case may be, God said that when you explain this to them, they will listen to you. But Moshe then follows that up by saying, they won't listen to me. And then God goes along with that and gives them the signs. What's the relationship then? What's the purpose of the signs? And what connection does it have with the request for the names? We're going to turn now to the Moreh Nevuchim, who has a chapter on this. This is on the paperback edition, page 93. Before approaching the subject of this chapter, we will first consider the words of Moshe, quote, "And they shall say unto me, what is his name? What shall I say unto them?" End of quote. Now back to the Rambam. How far was this question, anticipated by Moshe, appropriate? And how far was he justified in seeking to be prepared with the answer? Moshe was correct in declaring, "But behold, they will not believe me, for they will say, the Lord hath not appeared unto thee." This is a very, very startling development. It seems to go contrary to the criticism that's leveled at Moshe Rabbeinu for saying it. Superficially, the criticism would seem to be that Moshe was saying that they were not believers, that they wouldn't believe. That's very, very difficult, in my opinion, to sustain that shot in light of the pasuk, where God does not rebuke Moshe, and God, to the contrary, gives him proof, gives him what he wants. And God says, in order that they l'man yaminu, so that they should believe. If that's the case, then Moshe's request seems to be in line with the truth. That indeed is what the Rambam is saying. Back to the Rambam. For any man claiming the authority of a prophet
must expect to meet with such an objection so long as he has not given a proof of his mission. So that's a very, very amazing thing. That is to say that according to Judaism, I think this is contrary to what most people's attitude is. Most people's attitude is that you believe some type of faith. Maminim, we believe. And if a person were to come to us, well, not now that we have the Torah, it's a different story, but in general, the notion itself, that at a certain point in time, somebody approached a group of people. He was a very impressive type of individual, I assume. And for whatever reason, he had the aura that made people feel like they wanted to believe him, and he had this wonderful message. So then the idea of people believing him, that makes sense, that's faith. According to Judaism, that is utter and absolute nonsense. One should not believe anything unless it makes sense to believe it. One has to live in accordance with one's mind. And thus, according to the Rambam, this is Moshe's concern. He assumes, according to this, to the contrary, it's not a criticism of the Jews. It would be something positive about the Jews that they won't believe. The way I understand it, and according to my understanding, because I don't understand at this point what motivated Chazal to criticize Moshe, but on the level that we're studying it here now, to the contrary, it's a compliment. That is, if somebody was sent to a people and told to tell these people that God sent you, and says, okay, I'll just go ahead, and doesn't bring up this point, that is insult, because you're saying these people will just accept whatever is told to them. But to the contrary, by saying that they won't believe it without a proof, that they'll need a proof, because Moshe didn't say that they're not believers if they have a proof. So this is a compliment. Back to the Rambam. Again, if the question, as appears at first sight, referred only to the name as a mere utterance of the lips. When he says a mere utterance of the lips, he just means a name of designation, description, an ordinary name. The following dilemma would present itself. Either the Israelites knew the name, or they had never heard it. If the name was known to them, they would perceive in it no argument in favor of the mission of Moshe, his knowledge and their knowledge of the divine name being the same. If, on the other hand, they had never heard it mentioned, and if the knowledge of it was to prove the mission of Moshe, what evidence would they have that this was really the name of God? In short, producing the name is of no significance, no consequence, doesn't prove anything in terms of the mission, as the Rambam explains. Moreover, after God had made known that name to Moshe and had told them, go and gather the elders of Israel, and they shall hearken to thy voice. Moshe replied, behold, they will not believe me, nor hearken unto my voice, although God had told them, and they will hearken to thy voice. Whereupon God answered, what is that in your hand? And he said, a rod. So that's another question. That does God tells them that they will listen to you and they'll go with you to Paro. And Moshe comes back and says, no, they won't believe me. And then God goes, okay, fine, what's in your hand? Then God gives him the signs. So it's very difficult to follow what's going on over here. In order to obviate this dilemma, we're reading in the Rambam now, in the Morah, now we're on page 94. You must understand what I am about to tell you. You know how widespread were in those days the opinions of the Sabians. That was a group of idol worshippers. All men, except a few individuals, were idolaters. That is to say, they believed in spirits, in man's power to direct the influences of the heavenly bodies, and in the effect of talismans. So people were involved in idolatry, projection of powers onto various forces within the realm of the created world, and there were certain people they maintained and certain objects that could control these forces. Anyone who in those days laid claim to authority based it either like Abraham on the fact that by reasoning and by proof he had been convinced of the existence of a being who rules the whole universe,
or that some spiritual power was conferred upon him by a star, by an angel, or by a similar agency. Well, that's not the way Avraham worked. That is to say, there were two possible ways in which a person would seek to influence people. One is the way of Avraham, through reason, through knowledge. The other one, from religious, idolatrous types who sought to exploit the ignorance, was to try and convince people that some force, some star, had conferred certain powers upon them. Of course, that second method was the method of the idol worshippers. But we're concerned over here with the method of those who had the truth, the method of Avram. The method of Avram was to resort purely to ideas, to knowledge, to reason. But no one could establish his claim on prophecy. That is to say, on the fact that God had spoken to him or had entrusted a mission to him. Before the days of Moshe, no such assertion had ever been made. That's the point, that the phenomenon of prophecy as a vehicle for convincing people of what they ought to do, that a certain individual would utilize prophecy as a vehicle to convince people that they should do something because God had communicated this message to them via the prophet. That was something that did not exist up to this point. You must not be misled by the statements that God spoke to the patriarchs or that he had appeared to them. So now the Rambam is dealing with that. He's not saying that there was no prophecy before that point. There was. For you do not find any mention of a prophecy which appealed to others or which directed them. Abraham, Isaac, or Jacob, or any other person before them, did not tell the people, God said unto me, you shall do this thing, or you shall not do that thing, or God has sent me to you. You won't find that recorded with regard to the patriarchs, the avos, that they relate to people on that basis. Far from it. For God spoke to them on nothing but of what especially concerned them, i.e., he communicated to them things relating to their perfection, directed them in what they should do, and foretold them what the condition of their descendants would be, nothing beyond this. The Rambam is saying is that God did communicate with them, but all those communications were of personal concern to them, whether it be in commanding them to do a certain mitzvah, like milah, circumcision, or in what they should do in a particular situation. God reassured Yaakov before he went down to Egypt that he could go there and God would be with him in Egypt and God would remove his children from Egypt. But there was no communication which was to be utilized in order to communicate with mankind on that basis. They didn't do that. They guided their fellow men by means of argument and instruction, as is implied, according to the interpretation generally received amongst us, in the words, quote, and the souls that they had gotten in Charan, ha-nefesh ashekanu b'charan, that they had acquired. So, according to the interpretation of Chazal, it refers to people that they had won over to the truth. That's what the Torah describes, vayikra sham b'shem Hashem kel olam, that Avram called out in the name of God. The methodologies that Avram used to bring people over to a knowledge of God and to his service were reason. Reason, logic. Of course, he also utilized chesed. He was kind, compassion, treated them in a certain way, and brought them through all of these natural means towards a recognition of God, but did not in any way seek to influence them with the idea that God had commanded him, that he was in touch with God and God had commanded him to do such and such. When God appeared to our teacher Moses and commanded him to address the people and to bring them the message, well, you see, pause here. This backs up what I said before, that the Torah doesn't record every aspect of the dialogue. Because what we read until now doesn't say that God commanded him to address the people at this point. But we have to infer that he already had. And that's when Moshe replied that he might first be asked to prove the existence of God in the universe, and that only after doing so would he be able to announce to them that God had sent him. For all men, with few exceptions, were ignorant of the existence of God. Their highest thoughts did not extend beyond the heavenly sphere, its forms, or its influences. They could not yet emancipate themselves from sensation, and had not yet attained to any intellectual perfection. What we do not know over here is the numbers. What the Rambam is saying is that this was, he's explaining the question of Moshe. The request for the name was not really for a name, as we understand it. It was something else, which he expresses through the use of the term name. But he was anticipating that he'd be challenged on the very existence of such a being, which would indicate that significant numbers of the Jews had slipped, had regressed into idolatry, and no longer knew of the existence of this being, of the Supreme Being. And that's what he's saying. And before he could even establish that this being had communicated with him, he'd have to establish that this being exists and shore up their beliefs and the correct idea of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, of God. Then God taught Moshe how to teach them and had to establish amongst them the belief in the existence of himself, namely by saying Ekyer Asher Ekyer, a name derived from the verb Haya, in the sense of existing. Okay, the term Haya connotes to be, to exist, existence. For the verb Haya denotes to be, and in Hebrew no difference is made between the verbs to be and to exist. The principal point in this phrase is that the same word which denotes existence is repeated as an attribute. Before we go further in the words of the Rambam, whenever you use the term asher, that is, you mean to predicate something, you have a noun, like the shirt, asher, that is, then you'll say a color, that is white, that is blue, that is gray. The second one has to predicate, give you more information about the first thing. You'll never say the shirt, that is the shirt. I mean, that wouldn't make any sense at all, but something like that seems to be happening over here. So let's go back to the text. The word asher, that, corresponds to the Arabic iladi and ilati. I don't know Arabic, I'm just reading. And is an incomplete noun that must be completed by another noun. Okay, we understand that. The word that, the word asher, in and of itself is incomplete, but it's the beginning of a predicate. The first noun which is to be described is ekya. The second, by which the first is described, is likewise ekya, the identical word, as if to show that the object which is to be described and the attribute by which it is described are in this case necessarily identical. This is therefore the expression of the idea that God exists, but not in the ordinary sense of the term. Or in other words, he is the existing being, which is the existing being. That is to say, the being whose existence is absolute. This is an expression of the idea that the existence of God, when we refer to God's existence, it's unlike, it's different than any other type of existence. The Rambam mentions that in the beginning of Yisodei HaTorah, our idea of God, that he is the cause of all existence. Every other existence is contingent upon his, the truth of his existence. The life of God is different than our life. By us, it's something which is an accident. We derive our existence. It's an accidental phenomenon. That's why our existence requires a cause. And you can't ask who created God, because that question of who created refers only to a being that doesn't have to exist, that there's not necessary existence. So that's what it's saying, Ekya, the existing being, Asher Ekya, who exists by definition, whose existence is essential, whose existence is part of his nature, absolute existence. That's the concept that he's supposed to communicate to the Jewish people. Back to the text. The proof which he was to give consisted in demonstrating that there is a being of absolute existence, that has never been and never will be without existence. This I will clearly prove. But he's not going into that proof. But what he's telling over here is that in those few words of Ekya Asher Ekya, what God is telling him is that he is to communicate this proof, to prove to them that there is such a being, and the specific idea would be in terms of the difference between the existence of God and everything else that exists. God thus showed Moshe the proofs by which his existence would be firmly established among the wise men of his people. This also accounts for the fact that it's the Zakenim. It's the wise men, the intellectual leaders. Therefore, the explanation of the name is followed by the words, "Go gather the elders of Israel," and by the assurance that the elders would understand what God had shown to him and would accept it, as is stated in the words, "And they will hearken to thy voice." Now we understand part one. When it says they will hearken to thy voice, it says they'll accept the proof that there is such a being of absolute existence. Then Moses replied as follows. They will accept the doctrine that God exists, convinced by these intelligible proofs. But, said Moses, by what means shall I be able to show that this existing God has sent me? That's something else. What he's saying is that it's one thing for people to listen to him and to be convinced that this being must exist, of the true idea of God. But there's a separate claim. You're saying that this being, who you just described, communicates with people and has communicated with you, and we should follow this particular communication. How do we know that? That doesn't follow from the fact that you've been able to prove that he exists, that you have a specific communication. That's the question. So he's saying again that this claim of prophecy has to be established by proof. Thereupon God gave him the sign. And that's the end of that's the Rambam solution to the dilemma. Never mind the criticism of Moshe that he said that they will not believe. According to the Rambam, it makes perfect sense. And he was correct in saying that. Let's continue now to finish up the chapter. We have thus shown that the question, "What is his name?" means, "Who is that being which according to your belief has sent you?" Because remember, he had a problem. What kind of a name is this? What's the idea of the name? Either they know the name or they don't know the name. What he's saying over here now, that Moshe is referring to something else. The real question is, what is the concept of God? What is the idea of the God that you're talking about? And he's just using the word name to refer to that. The sentence, "What is his name?" instead of "Who is he?" has been here used as a tribute of praise and homage, as though it had been said, "Nobody can be ignorant of your essence and your real existence. If nevertheless I ask, what is your name? I mean, what idea is to be expressed by the name?" Now we have in parentheses over here, Moses considered it inappropriate to say to God that any person was ignorant of God's existence, and therefore described the Israelites as ignorant of God's name, not as ignorant of him who was called by that name. Just to summarize the last part, the way the Rambam understands it, Moshe spoke this way out of respect. He did not want to characterize the question of the Jews as asking about whether this being exists, because that would indicate that they were ignorant of his existence. And to even say a thing like that would be disrespectful. So to avoid that, he couched it in the words, "What is your name?" But God, in responding to him, didn't really give him a name in the ordinary sense, but gave him a concept, an idea, by which he was to demonstrate to them the existence of this type of being and what we mean, what we have in mind when we speak about this being. We now have a clear understanding of what's going on over here. It turns out that this is vital. That is, in order to establish the mission, the basis of the mission, it is founded on the presupposition that people are not expected to just accept it.
That's not to say that there might have been people that would accept it, you would think, given the state that they were in, of being downtrodden. But nevertheless, it's based upon the idea that people will utilize their intelligence, their chachma, and come to the correct conclusion on the basis of their seichel, of their reason. Thus, if that is the case, Moshe anticipated that he would have to deal with two issues. That first he have to establish beyond any doubt the existence of the being, the existence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and what concept is to be communicated to them, and how he should demonstrate it to them. That's first. First they have to be convinced with their minds, with reason, with knowledge of God's existence. The second thing is the idea of prophecy, but not just the idea of prophecy in the abstract, but the fact that Moshe himself was a prophet, that he had received the prophecy, is not something that can be established by reason, but can only be established by demonstrations. And that's the purpose of the signs that God gave him.